You're listening to 95.1 FM AM 1080 KYMN Radio in beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota. Good morning. My name is Rich Larson, and you are listening to Legal Talk with Justice Gordon Moore of the Minnesota State Supreme Court. Good morning, Gordon. How are you, sir?
Great, Rich. It definitely has an October feel to it tonight, or maybe even a November feel.
I was going to say, this is like what you wake up to on Thanksgiving morning.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's brisk out there, but it's great to be down at the station again for another episode of Legal Talk.
Thank you, sir. It's good to have you here. I always enjoy our conversations. This has really been a fun little project to be working on.
Yeah, I hope the listening audience has also found something helpful or interesting about it. It's, you know, we try to hit issues that we think are of interest, and frankly, it's a little hard to gauge sometimes, but we've got a few interesting things to talk about this month.
We do indeed. So before we get into it, we're going to talk about election law today. Before we get into that, what's been happening up at the Supreme Court this month?
Well, we are getting back to what I would characterize as normal. Last week, for the first time in the time that I've been on the court, since March of 2020, we used our second courtroom in the Minnesota Judicial Center, which is a little smaller. That had been our Zoom courtroom during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. It had been reserved for the Chief Justice only. But we were back in there. Generally, we're second week of oral arguments are there, and that was fun. It was actually fun to be the person who gets to knock on the door, because the junior justice in that configuration is the first one to enter the courtroom, so I had to fulfill that important responsibility. Uh-huh. Although the reviews were mixed as to how it went, frankly, so apparently I've got some work to do on knocking.
You gotta work on your knock.
Yeah, there's a debate of whether it's two or three and those sorts of things. Really fun last Tuesday, Rich, we went to Shakopee for the traveling high school roadshow oral argument. Mm-hmm. That was held before a very attentive and appreciative audience of high school students and staff at Shakopee High School, which is amazing. That school is something else. I had never been there. But we argued a criminal case that was chosen by the commissioner's office before students, and it was a real argument. I mean, this wasn't fake. It was a real argument. And then after that, we came back out on stage, and the students could ask us questions one at a time. And so that happened for about 25 minutes, and then their culinary arts program prepared just a wonderful lunch, and then four of us stuck around for tours of the facility, and then we talked to classrooms, and I got to do that, and that was a blast.
That's neat.
That was really fun. We got in and just to answer questions. Some of it was college prep material, others related to the work of the court, and the students really did a nice job of thinking about, you know, questions that were relevant and important, you know, not kind of random or inappropriate things. So it worked, the staff at Shakopee did a fantastic job in getting things ready, and it went as well as could be expected.
I'm trying to think about how jazzed I would have been if a Supreme Court justice had come in and talked to my 11th grade government class. And I think I probably would be talking about it to this day.
For some kids, you could tell it was really meaningful. Shakopee has an academy model for their school where they divide their school up into six learning communities they call academies. And they had students that really auditioned to be guides. Mm-hmm. Each justice had two guides and, you know, very attentive and thoughtful, young people that really cared about what they were doing. And it was a great day. Good day for the court. I think the court felt really good about being back out in the road. It had been a few years.
Yeah, that's fantastic. All right, so what do we have coming up in November then?
Well, November has, I would say, kind of a typical array of cases starting October 31st. We have some workers' compensation cases and some tax cases that probably aren't necessarily interesting to the general public, obviously very interesting to the people involved. But I did select a couple of cases that I thought the audience might be interested in knowing about. On November 9th, we are hearing the review of the Court of Appeals decision to affirm in part and reverse in part a water discharge permit issued by the Pollution Control Agency to Polymet Mining for the Northmet Mining Project. For those of you who aren't aware of it, Polymet has proposed the first copper nickel mine in Minnesota in the vicinity of Babbitt and White Lakes on the Iron Range. And there are a variety of permits, environmental permits, that state regulatory agencies have to issue in order for this mining operation to commence. And this water permit is a water discharge permit in particular is a critical component of that. And so case has percolated through the administrative process up through the Court of Appeals, and now it lands on us. And to give you an indication of the level of interest, we have six outside groups that have filed amicus briefs or friend of the court briefs advocating for their position on it. So some environmental groups, some more industry-related groups. And so we hear that on that's actually the last case of the November calendar on Wednesday the 9th, and I think it merits that. It frankly probably merits, you know, individual consideration that day. I think it's getting that. The previous day, you know, we have cases that go the gamut, and I picked out one criminal case in State versus Douglas on November 8th, Election Day. We're going to consider whether unaltered tinfoil is a device, gear, or instrument designed to assist in shoplifting or defeat an electronic article surveillance system. The defendant there was accused of using tinfoil to preclude a theft detection device from being activated. And so the question is, was tinfoil designed as a device, gear, instrument to assist in shoplifting, unaltered tinfoil? And so it's, you know, again, and the grand scheme of the criminal cases in the state of Minnesota, you know, it's not a life or death issue, but for that, for Mr. and Ms. Douglas, they were convicted of shoplifting and, you know, have a conviction on the record. And so the Court of Appeals issued a statutory interpretation analysis, and we're going to take that up on the 8th. And so that's, you know, kind of a unique little issue.
Yeah. I you can't comment on any of this, but I didn't even realize that was even a thing.
You know, the legislature, let's just say that efforts to try to violate the law are, you know, have existed since territorial days, and the legislature sometimes is proactive and sometimes is reactive in response to ways that people are trying to circumvent the law, and this shoplifting device statute may be one of those issues. But yeah, I can't say anything more about it other than to say live streaming occurs every day. We have oral arguments on, and those are two cases that people might be interested in popping in to listen to.
Going back to this Polymet case, another topic you can't comment on, but I want to make a plug for another one of my shows. About a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, on Public Policy This Week, we had former Governor Arne Carlson on our show, and he has some strong opinions on the whole Polymet and actually mining in the Lake Superior watershed all together. And for those of you who are interested, I would direct you to your favorite podcast platform or to kymnradio.net. Look up Public Policy This Week and Governor Carlson's thoughts on the Polymet situation.
There are a lot of intensely held issues, and one of the parties involved is one of the Indian tribes that is directly affected.
Is it Red Lake? That's right.
I think
there?
It's Boyce Fort.
Okay, it might be.
I haven't read that case yet, but I believe it is. So, you know, the bands have an interest. Mm-hmm. The state has an interest. Obviously, you know, there's union mining interests.
Yeah.
And so it's complex. But obviously the welfare of the environment is critical. But I think what's really at issue in the Polymet case is the process.
Yeah.
Because, you know, administrative agencies have a lot of authority. This has been a debate at the U.S. Supreme Court level, the so-called administrative state, you know, kind of folks that are, you know, upset about how much authority has been delegated to administrative agencies, you know, elements or arms of the executive branch in order to make decisions on things like permitting. And it's a very technical and specialized area involving science and, you know, we delegate a lot of authority to those agencies. And the question is, what process are they using? How much public notice are they giving? And how are they considering the various questions. And then, you know, on review, one of the issues the appellate courts have to decide is how much deference or how much do we defer to decisions of administrative agencies regarding issues of their expertise.
Sure.
And this is a big deal. The North Met project is a big deal. We have had other cases in front of them, and so I'm sure that will have a lot of interest.
To be clear, this is not a case that will decide if PolyMet is going to be able to mine in northern Minnesota.
No. This is a permit. They have to have certain types of air and water permits in order to, in order to be licensed to do the mining.
Yeah.
And the discharge, the water discharge is critically important because of, you know, the byproducts of mining, and does that leach into the watershed, and does that, as Governor Carlson indicated, affect the Lake Superior watershed specifically.
Yeah.
So there's a ton of interest there parties up there.
You just raised my eyebrows, because that's something I'm very interested in. I'm going to be paying close attention. I'll even go on and online and watch those arguments.
Bancourts.gov, Supreme Court.
November 9th.
So November 9th, yeah. So those our calendar, we have a variety of other interesting cases that we really don't have time to talk about. But first 2 weeks of the month are the oral argument months, generally Monday through Thursday, the first week, and then Monday through Wednesday, the second week.
Okay. So, I don't know if you've noticed or not, but there's an election coming up here pretty quickly, sir.
Yes, there is. And the election season for the Supreme Court is a really intense one because, you know, in addition to people being on the ballot, full disclosure, including me and my colleague Justice Hudson, there are cases that come directly to the Supreme Court involving election issues. The Supreme Court has jurisdiction to hear what are called petitions to correct errors in ballots under state statute. And these have to be dealt with immediately because, you know, with ballot printing deadlines, the Supreme Court has the obligation to give direction to the election official, Secretary of State, as to what to do. And so, yes, we have been busy, and these are not part of our scheduled docket. These are things that just pop up and they have to be dealt with immediately.
Right. This is just people elbowing their way onto your schedule, basically.
They are. And it, well, and for I'll give you a couple of examples of scenarios that we've had to deal with.
Yeah.
We deal with errors or omissions in the placement or printing of ballots in the name or description of candidates. We've got two cases pending right now that I am not part of because I'm on the general ballot where counties failed to include the word incumbent by judges, which is required, and failed to include party designations on other candidates.
Oh.
And then there was a case in Ramsey County that we dealt with in October. In Ramsey County, ballots were printed that did not list the correct Republican Party candidate for House District 67A.
Oh, really?
Accidentally listed a person who had sadly passed away in August of 2022. The Republican Party had nominated a replacement, and it was just a glitch. Some of the ballots didn't include the appropriate candidate. So we had to fix that.
Sure.
Nobody was opposing it, but somebody has to do something about it.
I want to, if you don't mind, I want to go back to one. Just, I have a quick question about what you're talking about. When you are given a question about judges on the ballot and you are yourself on the ballot, is that something you have to recuse yourself, or are you just automatically excused from that situation?
Two answers to that. On any case involving the ballot where a member of the court is on the ballot, the members of the court that are on the ballot become respondents, because under the law, the party seeking correction of the ballot has to serve everybody who's on the ballot, including the judges.
Okay.
And so you can't be deciding a case where you're frankly a party.
Right.
We are technically a party. So on these two ballot correction cases I just referenced from, they're actually from Northwest Minnesota, I am recused from those cases.
Okay.
But we did have one ballot correction case, as you might remember, that involved recusal of the entire Supreme Court. And that was in 1992 when Alan Page filed a petition challenging the Secretary of State's refusal to place his name on the ballot in 1992 for the position of Associate Justice of the state Supreme Court.
I had forgotten about
and
that.
And it was what had happened was Justice Yetka, Lawrence Yetka, was retiring, and Justice Yetka asked Governor Carlson to extend his term of office to October of 1994. It would have ended in, I believe, at the end of 1992 otherwise. And the Governor Carlson did issue that order, which was allowed under the statute, and that mm-hmm. eliminated the election for his seat on the 1992 Supreme Court ballot. Alan Page challenged that and won and got mm-hmm. on the ballot as a result of that and ended up winning, you know, handily. But the entire court recused in that case because that involved membership of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court appointed 7 district court or court of appeals judges to sit as the Supreme Court in that case.
Interesting.
And that, that was an example where we all got recused. So,
we
do have to be really careful about that because it's important, again, perception as well as the reality of justice that we're mm-hmm. not, you know, we're not viewed as having our hand on the scale in one way or the other.
No, you cannot. You cannot even give even remotely that appearance.
Right. Other challenges to ballots this year have involved the byproducts of redistricting, where because of the changes in House and Senate districts, some incumbents got, you know, sort of redistricted out of a seat, and they mm-hmm. had to move within 6 months of the general election in order to establish residency in a new district to run there. And we've had at least 2 cases where challengers have alleged that the person claiming to live in District X didn't actually live there.
Right.
And so, you know, they had, you know, in one case, we actually appointed a Court of Appeals judge to act as a referee to take evidence about, well, you know, what was the evidence? And there was photographs of, mm-hmm. you know, unmowed lawns and, you know, garbage cans not being emptied and things like that. And we've had a few of those. And that those things do happen after redistricting, particularly where you've got boundary changes.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see here. Petition that was from 21 was the challenge to the language on the Minneapolis public safety ballot,
right.
The charter ballot, where the voters in Minneapolis were asked to amend the city charter to remove language regarding the police department and to replace it with the Department of Public Safety. And challengers asked for that to be stricken from the ballot because they claimed that the language on the ballot was misleading or mm-hmm. inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
The court denied that, and of course the ballot measure actually did fail.
In a situation like that, the court, it's sort of a yes or no thing. The court can't, would the court be able to amend the language to that referendum itself? Or would they just have to rule, yeah, that language is okay, or no, that language is not right?
It really depends, Rich, on the circumstances of how much of it could be severed. I think there is the ability, if there's language that could clearly be removed, but it's generally a yes or a no.
Yeah.
I mean, the local ballot officials have worked on these things, and generally, you know, I think there's pretty good case law that, you know, the language doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, there's room for, you know, inaccuracies, or I guess, you know, subtle inaccuracies, but it has to convey the essence of the actual initiative. And that was part of the question there. The, you know, I think we said it was perhaps imperfect, but it was sufficient.
Okay.
And there was in 2019, just to end this discussion, there was a City of St. Paul garbage referendum initiative that got a lot of traction in the City of St. Paul. If the listeners know people that reside in the City of St. Paul, the hauling of waste and garbage is kind of complex. And in 2019, we affirmed a district court order that directed the City of St. Paul to put a referendum question regarding the city's garbage hauling ordinance on the ballot for a municipal election.
Okay.
So those are some examples of ballot correction measures.
Sure.
And you know, oftentimes what we do is we issue an immediate order with an opinion to follow, because, you know, oftentimes we have to literally within hours or days have have to direct the local election officials, you know, can you count this ballot? Do you spoil these ballots, the absentee, et cetera? And they need direction, and then we try to supplement it with a decision that explains why.
Is there a time limit on how long you have to issue your the decision? Well, you issued the decision, but the explanation?
No, the explanation can come out whenever but the order is dictated by election deadlines and, frankly, printing deadlines for ballots.
Right.
You know, because that's just the reality of it. You know, things don't happen immediately, and we do still have printed ballots in this state.
Yeah,
you know, we're not all electronic by any means, and so we are doing printed ballots. And finally, on, you know, the one area where the court gets involved in election law that is publicly notable would be in the whole election recount issue.
Yes. Yeah.
We've had some big ones over the years.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the Supreme Court has jurisdiction by statute to address election contests in cases involving candidates for state office.
Mm-hmm.
And one that listeners might remember is in 2009, the Frank and Coleman Senate recount. The 2009, the court appointed a 3-judge panel to hear an election contest involving the Senate election. It was Norm Coleman was the incumbent, Franken was the challenger. By statute, the margin separating the two candidates was less than 0.5% of the total number of votes counted for the office.
As I recall, it was like 200 votes.
It was after canvassing, it was 206 votes in Coleman's favor. What happened was there was a statewide manual recount mandatory recount. I was county attorney in Nobles County at that time, and I remember vividly that day of, you know, people appointed to examine every ballot with, you know, representatives of both campaigns watching. It was pretty intense. The statewide manual recount considered previously rejected absentee ballots, and that was one of the controversial areas of that.
Absentee ballots.
That tends to be, you know, those are counted sometimes last.
Mm-hmm.
The election was certified after the recount by 225 votes in Franken's favor, and then after they had a trial, the court appointed a 3-judge panel to hear the contest. And after that, Franken's margin bumped up to all of 312 votes.
Right.
And so that was the final outcome of that. Previously, in December of 1962, the court got involved in the closest race for governor in state history. That was the Carl Rovog Elmer Anderson election. That was another dispute over the counting of recording of votes. And that's really, frankly, where these disputes come up. We saw that in Florida in 2000 in the Bush versus Gore case. But after re-canvassing, Anderson led by 142 votes, and after a dispute over amended returns from different counties, the final margin of that election was 91 votes out of 1.2 million cast in favor of Carl Rovog for governor.
Wow,
and so those are tight elections, and tight elections happen. I mean, that doesn't mean there's any conspiracies or anything nefarious. We just live, frankly, in somewhat, you know, polarized times right now, and there's a lot of 50-50 elections out there. So it wouldn't surprise me if we saw some stuff after this election.
I would not be surprised at all if you guys get a little bit busy after the 8th of November.
I think... I'm just going to put in a plug for election officials in Minnesota. I mean, I've worked with election officials at the state level and at the local level, and I believe our elections are run fairly and competently and impartially.
Yeah.
You know, the local election officials are people that are just trying to do a job.
Right.
They're just trying to count the votes.
Right.
And, you know, I know it gets political the farther you go up the chain, but it is... been my experience that elections in Minnesota have avoided some of the problems in other states.
Right.
Let's keep it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's keep it that way. All right, we just have a few minutes left, but with our few minutes, I want to ask you about your thoughts, maybe, and maybe some advice to people on the elected judiciary in Minnesota. This is a little weird because you yourself are on the ballot this year. But we have a process in Minnesota, and I don't know if this is the way it works just statewide across the country or not. But we elect our judges in Minnesota. And, you know, even for someone like me who's very politically minded and really tries to pay attention to what's going on and who the candidates are and where, you know, where they coincide with my own values, I flip that ballot over and all of these judges are on the back of that ballot. And Gordon, I have to tell you, 9 times out of 10, I have to leave those things blank because I don't know. And part of the problem you run into there is if it's an incumbent who's running unopposed and you don't vote, that's a no vote. That's a vote that counts against the incumbent. So it can be, it can affect things. Without commenting on the system, unless you want to comment on the system, I suppose, is there a good resource that you know of for people to go and just sort of look at what they're going to be asked to vote on and at least give them some sort of idea of what they're looking at?
Well, Rich, you're correct. There is the we urge people to flip the ballot and look at page 2 because those are the judicial elections. And it's really important that people do a little thinking about that because voters will be asked to vote for the judges that are on the statewide ballot. That would be the Supreme Court justices that are up for election as well as Court of Appeals judges. And then in each judicial district, you know, voters will vote for the judges within that district. And they may be from people. For example, you know, we're in the third judicial district here. There could be a judge from Winona County, Houston County. I know there's a judge from Houston County on the ballot that, you know, frankly, without even the lawyers in Rice County might not really have had any reason to get to know.
Right.
And that's just the way it goes.
Right.
We don't elect judges by county or where they seat. We elect them by judicial district or statewide office. I firmly believe that the process sort of polices itself. If you've got a judge that's frankly been in trouble or is trouble, I think you will generally see challengers to that person.
Okay.
You will see campaigns. If you don't see that, that's generally, I think, a sign that there's not an indication by the bar that there's any great concern. But to find out about those judges, I would recommend that that voters go to the state court's website. There's a link on the bottom to judicial officers.
Okay.
And you can search by county, you can search by district, you can search by court. So, for example, if you want to see the biographies of the judges on the Supreme Court, you could click on that. A third district, you could look at that and see, okay, you know, for instance, Judge King in Olmsted County, you know, she was a public defender before she came on the bench. Judge Storino in Houston County, you know, what was her background? And you could see a little bit of their community involvement. Now, that is not, those aren't campaign websites. Those are, that's information on the state judicial website. Some candidates do have websites, particularly if there's a contested election. There is one in Scott County. The first judicial district, Judge Chuck Weber is being challenged. His is the only contested seat out of 105 in the state this year, which is extraordinary.
Wow.
And so Judge Weber does have a website. You could go to his website, and I think his opponent may as well. And, you know, those are obviously partisan, not politically partisan, but they're put on by supporters of the candidate. Candidates. But
yes.
Most uncontested elections don't involve websites or campaigns. I think most judges don't think that it's really appropriate to be doing a ton of campaigning if they don't have a challenger on the theory that, you know, asking people to give money for an uncontested election seems a little awkward.
Yes.
But it does create an information vacuum. I don't deny that. Generally, the State Bar Association puts out some information about judges closer to the election. I think one thing I would recommend voters do is talk to attorneys that they might know.
Okay.
If they have an attorney or if they've got a friend that's an attorney,
yeah.
Or for the local elections, you know, talk to law enforcement. Sometimes law enforcement or probation officers, social workers, people that work in the court and they see these judges on the bench and on their, you know, in the in daily basis, you know, it can tell you a lot about the way that judges handle their business and what type of people they are, how involved they are in their cases, the community. We have a very good, and this is a little self-serving, I acknowledge, our Judicial Selection Commission in the state of Minnesota is very good, frankly, at getting people recommended to the governor for judgeships that are of the type of people that we should have on the bench.
People that belong there.
Yes, and people that don't belong there, frankly, Rick, get screened out. Okay. Because the Judicial Selection Commission is comprised of people appointed by the court and by the governor, and they do deep vetting of candidates for judicial positions. They're doing calling, they're talking to stakeholders, attorneys, other judges, law enforcement officers, opposing counsel, and they're looking for character issues, they're looking for temperament questions. They're looking for knowledge, expertise, health-related issues that are pertinent to the job. And so that process, I think, really works to weed out folks that really shouldn't be on the bench.
So if I'm looking at a ballot, not necessarily knowing the decisions one way or the other, tendencies of a judge, I can be confident that this person has been deemed to be competent and deserving of a judgeship.
Almost all of the candidates on the ballot, with a few exceptions, were appointed by a governor.
Yeah.
And it could be, you know, frankly, we may still have some Governor Ventura appointees on the bench. We definitely have Pawlenty and Dayton and Walz appointees. We might even have a Arne Carlson appointee or two around still. And you can be assured that each of those governors took their responsibility to appoint judges really seriously. And the judicial selection commissions that those governors worked with had the same thing. I mean, these are merit selection panels that are comprised of, frankly, all-stars. And these are people that our governors are putting their trust in to basically, frankly, not embarrass them and not embarrass the people of the state of Minnesota by putting somebody there who shouldn't be there.
Right.
And so, you know, it in my opinion, works really well. That said, the governor doesn't have to appoint somebody from the judicial that is recommended by the Judicial Selection Commission. There have been a few examples of candidates put on the bench that have been outside that process. That is a lot less than it used to be. But I'll give former Governor Quay the credit. The Quay Commission in the early 80s was the first effort to put together a body to really screen and look at judicial merit for the appointment to the bench. And it's been followed by governors of, you know, well, Jesse Ventura, Reform Party, Republican, Democrat, have all followed it. And I think it's led to a Minnesota judiciary that citizens can have trust in. That doesn't mean that they're going to agree with every decision made. Of course, they won't. You know, if you're involved in a case and it goes against you, that can be frustrating. But in my experience, I just hung out with the district court judges at their conference a few weeks ago. These are people that care deeply about their jobs. And in some cases, Rich, these are people that have given up partnerships at frankly large law firms to take, you know, significant pay cuts because of public service and a desire to serve the people.
Right.
And I think voters, you know, when looking at a background of a candidate, if they see that type of transition, they know that's somebody that is really focused on public service.
Sure. Hanging out with district court judges at their conference, I bet that was a barn burner. I bet those people really know how to party, Greg.
They are a great group, and you know, judges getting together. Particularly when I was in outstate Minnesota, it was my one chance a year, actually two, there's two judge conferences, to see other judges that I wouldn't otherwise see.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a safe space for judges to talk to each other without having to worry about saying something that's overheard in a public cafe or something that could create trouble. They are good people. The district judges put on seminars on cases. I'll tell you, that's a little interesting to hear them talking about the Supreme Court's decisions over the past year, and when you know, when you're part of making those decisions that I never used to be, and so it's, you kind of have to sit there and grin and bear it a little bit. They make some fun of us once in a while, but they are a excellent group. They're a lot of fun, and they're super knowledgeable and passionate people about the cause that they're working on, and it's just inspiring to hang out with them for a few days.
That's great. Right. Well, we are at the end of our time, Justice Moore. I want to thank you again, as always, for taking some time and talking with us today. And thanks for taking the time to talk about election stuff. I think that's really important right now, and I think that's a conversation that's not had enough, and I think some people needed to hear it.
I agree. It is important for voters to flip that ballot. They can go online right now. For instance, the city of Northfield on their website, you can look at your ballot. Mm-hmm. You can find your ward and precinct, and you click, and you can look at your ballot in advance of going in, and you can see the judges that are there. And you could, if you've got the time and the inclination, can, you know, do a little research to say, hey, who am I voting for?
Right.
And, you know, no, you're not going to know every judge on that ballot, but hopefully you'll get a sense of who they are and what they represent. And, again, if you got questions, ask an attorney, ask a stakeholder. Generally, yes. Those people will tell you everything you need to know.
All right. Justice Gordon Moore of the Minnesota State Supreme Court, thank you, sir. And we will be back again on the third Monday of November, which I think will be right before Thanksgiving.
It will be, and it'll be post-election. So yeah. Hopefully, if there is anything that's gone on that's relevant, you know, if we can talk about it, we will.
Wouldn't it be great if things just were quiet?
It would be nice.
We just had a really uneventful election. Everything just went the way it was supposed to go.
I hope from the administration of the election standpoint that things go smoothly. Yeah. That's really what's important.
Unfortunately, I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah. So keep our fingers crossed, I guess. Okay.
Thank you, sir. And folks, you're listening to 95.1 KYMN Radio in beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota. We now return you to our regularly scheduled, eclectic, and wonderful group of music.